This is The Thirsty Developer, episode number 57 from Monday, April 6th, 2009, WPF and Stream-Oriented Computing. This week on The Thirsty Developer, we have an interview with Mike Brown, a Microsoft MVP on the Windows client platform. Mike talks about patterns in WPF and an application called Flow that he's built to demonstrate stream-oriented computing. Let's listen to the interview. Hi, this is Larry Clark, and I'm recording this podcast from on location in Indianapolis, Indiana. I'm down here for some events and some user groups and all kinds of fun stuff. And one of the things I really like about going to Indianapolis is I get to catch up with my old friend, Mike Brown. Mike, say hello to the folks. Tell us a little about yourself.
How are you doing?
What, we've known each other for almost 2 years now, right?
A couple years.
Yeah.
The backstory is that, you know, you live in Indianapolis now. That's where you got your family. You know, you're doing all kinds of things down here. But you came from, you know, the Milwaukee area, which is where I still live.
Right. I got involved with the developer community up in Milwaukee and bumped into you, kept hearing, hey, Larry Karkin. So everyone's
actually, I read your blog a few times before I actually met you.
Really?
Yes.
I keep hearing that. You know, it's weird because I've bumped into people at conferences, and I just went to the MVP summit. So I guess that's a big thing. So
yeah, we'll talk about that in a second.
Yes. You know. People who like I really respect in the community are like, oh yeah, everyone in our office reads your blog, and I'm like, wow, okay.
Yeah, I think it was Travis Feertag, who's our you know, friend from Madison, actually said, you know, hey, check out this blog, Mike Brown, local guy. And you actually, your kind of handle on the internet is Brownie Points.
Right.
And that's an homage to your last name, Mike Brown. So
right.
There's a lot of Browns, and there's probably a lot of Mike Browns, so you had to do something unique. So I thought Brownie Points was kind of a cool tagline anyway.
Yeah. You know, I did the ultimate in, you know, self-glorification and Googled myself, so. And I was actually impressed to find out I made the second page of Google.
Oh, like, that's not bad with a common name like that.
Yeah, yeah. So I was right after, you know, the safety for the Bears and guy from FEMA who got fired.
Yeah. Who was famous for George Bush saying, you know, you're doing a good job, Brownie.
You're doing a good job, Brownie. So,
Well, I'll tell you this. This is a little bit of an aside, but I absolutely own Larry Clarkin.
Okay.
If you put Larry Clarkin into any search engine, you know, whatever your favorite search engine is, I own just about all the results.
I didn't Google. I live searched myself.
Oh, no. I wasn't trying to point that out, but, yeah, so with a name like, you know, Mike Brown, you've got to do some things to distinguish yourself. And I thought Brownie Points was cool.
Yeah.
It's kind of a handle. If people want to follow you on Twitter, you're twitter.com/Brownie Points, right?
Brownie Points. I noticed you've disappeared from Twitter all of a sudden.
Yeah, we've talked about that on the show. Actually, though, I am back on Facebook.
Okay.
You know, anybody listening that, you know, I didn't lose my friends. You know, Facebook's got a really nice thing where if you leave for a while, you can come back, whatever.
Oh, okay.
I got into absolute social network overload.
Right.
I was just absolutely tired of updating stuff everywhere.
Right.
And it was distracting me from things that I really wanted to get accomplished, both in my professional and personal life. So I said, let me just unplug from a few of these things for a while. So.
Yeah. I think, you know, I went through that same scenario where I was on Twitter and, you know, I posted a few things for a while and I'm like, okay, well, this really sucks. And then someone said, well, did you download a desktop client? And I did that. I'm like, oh my God. It was like instant messaging all over again, you know?
Yeah. And my issue was that when I did get a desktop client, you know, I just was checking it too much. I was trying to follow the meme, the flow, you know, of information going on. You can't do that for too long. So.
Right.
The show, thirstydeveloper.com, is now on Twitter again.
Oh, okay. Though,
or we're on Twitter for the first time. So it's twitter.com/thirstyd. And maybe while we're talking, I'll sneak over here on my phone and you know, publish the first tweet that, you know, I'm interviewing at Brownie Points.
Oh, wow. Wow, I feel honored.
So everybody's listening to this and like, God, where are they going with this?
Right.
But you know, there's a little background about you. You've had a great accomplishment,
right?
And that is, you were recently named a Microsoft Most Valuable Professional.
Right.
So tell us a little bit about that.
For anyone who doesn't know, it's 4,200 professionals worldwide who are recognized with this. And after getting it, I did a lot of research and basically originated from the CompuServe days where, you know, people were contributing a lot of their time to answering questions for the community and really getting involved and basically acting as a volunteer evangelist for Microsoft. So I've got your job, but just not the pay grade.
I was going to say it's the unpaid evangelist, right, is what we like to call them. And really, it's an award.
Right.
It is not a job.
No.
Right. So what it is that they're, you know, Microsoft, the MVP program looks at thousands of people every year and what are their contributions to the community.
Right.
It's a community award. And says that, you know, hey, Mike, you've been contributing to the community.
Yeah.
You know, you speak, you blog, you Twitter, you probably answer, you know, questions on forums on occasion.
Yeah.
And it's a way of rewarding somebody, you know, with some nice perks.
Oh, yeah. Definitely, yeah. Nice perks.
And one of the best perks is you mentioned that you were at the MVP Summit.
Yes.
And tell us about that. And I know that the Microsoft rules are you can talk about the summit, but you can't talk necessarily about all the content of the
right,
summit.
Right. So If anyone noticed, like, basically the week of the summit, you know, the word was that our hashtag MVP09 was, like, the third most in volume on Twitter.
For those not on Twitter, what is a hashtag?
It's basically, you know, a way of tagging what content you put on Twitter. So you can say, oh, this is related to MVP09 was for the summit, or people will do like alt.net or whatever they want to say, you know, this content is related to that tag. So similar to Delicious or any of those other tagging sites.
It's a way to group things together.
Right.
Yeah. And do you know by chance what the other, what number one and number two were that week?
I think Britney Spears was one.
Oh.
And I can't remember what two was. But
probably Obama.
Yeah.
Pound Obama, yeah. You know. So, and by the way, pound Obama means the hashtag pound. I don't want to, you know, it's not going to do a political rant. But you got awarded your MVP, and the way the MVPs work is it's a specialty.
Right.
Right. So you don't get an MVP for being a great guy,
even though
Mike, you are a great guy.
Yeah.
You know, it's specifically for your contributions to a technology stack or an area. And what was yours in?
Client app dev. So, you know, basically I got the WPF bug and, you know, shortly after Beta 2 was released back in 06. So I've been yelling and ranting and raving about it to anyone who bothered to listen to me for those now 3 years almost.
So let's talk about WPF a bit.
Okay.
You know, can we take the conversation that way?
Sure.
You caught the WPF bug.
Yes.
And, you know, so, and I know that you're very passionate about it. What makes you so excited about WPF?
You know, I'm just a technology aficionado, period, you know, and WPF is definitely a paradigm shift from basically the prior UI stack, which was WinForms or MFC was what was available to us before. And I started learning about it, and the more I dived into the framework, the more I loved the new way of doing things. You know, you could do a lot of fancy tricks and stuff that's just not possible with WinForms it's possible, but not as easily in WinForms.
If you can drop down to GDI, pretty much anything's possible
right.
in WinForms, but you know, you don't want to spend all that time and effort doing that.
Right.
So you mentioned WPF is a paradigm shift. And I think that a lot of people, you know, talk about the learning curve associated with it. And a lot of it is, the, you know, not necessarily just the learning curve of I got to learn some new syntax, but it is those paradigm shift things.
Right.
So what are the couple of things that are really radically different about WPF?
Well, I think one thing that I've noticed about WPF is that it's somewhat of an opinionated framework, whereas WinForms lets you code in a certain way, you know, the event-driven model. So someone clicks a button and I respond to it with an event handler, you know, manipulate the form. WPF allows you to do that, but once you move past the event model, it's a lot more fluent. One pattern that's evolved and almost like it wasn't even a guided evolution. It was everyone, after working with it for a while, eventually said, well, I get much less friction by doing things this way. And it's what we in the WPF literati call call...
I'm going to have to go look up literati in Wikipedia or something.
I just made up a word, I think.
So the thought leaders in WPF, what do they call that?
The early adopters.
Okay.
We call it a model view, view model. Basically, the idea, you know, there's model view controller where you have a controller that guides the view, but the model also talks to the view also talks directly to the model in MVC.
Right.
There was another.
And MVC, if we could just diverge for a second, you know, that's primarily considered a web implementation.
Right.
I mean, it's possible because it is a true pattern that it could be on any platform.
Right.
But you see most of them on
the web.
Yeah.
Right.
And Ruby on Rails is famous for it. You know, PHP's got early implementations. There was a really early one on Java that's still popular today called Struts.
Right.
I'm trying to give people some examples. Yeah. And of course, you know, creativity was an all-time low when the ASP.NET MVC model was coined. We're calling it the ASP.NET MVC.
Right.
So it was the most descriptive, you know, name we've ever come up with. But,
right.
The concept there is that you've got a front end controller and a view and a model, and they're separate for a number of reasons, but primarily for, you know, the ability to unit test, you know, the user interface,
right,
the model portion of it.
Right. The view model, what it does is it just represents what the view is. So if a button is enabled, it'll have a property on there should button be enabled. This is interesting because WPF has a very rich binding story. So almost any element on your WPF controls or any property on the WPF controls can be bound to almost anything that you can think of in object. In WinForms and in ASP.NET, the story beyond the basic data source binding and or list binding wasn't as rich as what's in WPF. Because of that story, the presentation model or the view model allows you to really separate the concerns of how the UI looks from the logic that drives the UI.
Okay. Before we jump off of it, you know, the binding in WPF is really powerful. One of the things that I like to show to demonstrate, you know, the power of this is I actually will go grab a RESTful, you know, URL anywhere on the web.
Right.
And I like to pick non-Microsoft platform sites like Flickr.
Right.
Right. Or, you know, Twitter or, you know, any one of those. And actually, because the power is if you can get an XML endpoint URL and you can pull up, you know, Expression Blend.
Right.
It's a lot easier in Blend, you know.
Oh, yeah.
But you can actually data bind with literally just drag and drop controls.
Right.
And then you can apply a nice looking template to it to, you know, kind of fix up the size of, of things and things like that. But it really shows you the true flexibility and the fact that the binding is totally separate from any application code. So you can actually, and this is one of the walkthroughs in WPF, if anybody's interested in learning more about it, is actually building an RSS reader with like no code.
Yeah, that was
I think the refresh button, you know.
That was like the hello world of WPF, that and Twitter clients.
Yeah. Let's build a blog, you know, being the new hello world.
Right.
You know, let's build an RSS reader.
Right.
So the binding capabilities, you know, fantastic. But I still haven't wrapped my head around the model view, view model.
Okay.
You know, how would this, from a code standpoint, look if I've got a WPF project in front of me?
Okay. Well, see, your XAML, so that's the big thing about WPF is...
We're this far and we haven't even talked about XAML yet.
Right. So XAML is a declarative language for expressing your UI, very similar to a web page or HTML. So instead of, you know, WinForms, even though you could drag and drop, there was still code that was driving the UI creation. So
yeah, when I dragged a, you know, button onto a form, there was some code created in a little area called generated code.
Touch.
Yeah, they collapsed it with a region, so it was nice, you know, and with the warning,
right?
You know, do not touch this because you will break something.
Right.
XAML is different in the fact that the code is not generated at design time,
right?
But the objects that those represent are generated at runtime,
right?
Correct.
Right. So basically, XAML at its core is just an object creation language. So an object markup language. So the window which is usually the root in a WPF application, is actually represented in markup as a window tag. It represents the window object within the framework. It allows for a lot more flexibility in the way, you know, your UI is created. So now that we know XAML's there, you know, this separation between your actual UI as a markup language, its own artifact, I should say. Now you can look at what drives your UI as a separate entity. WPF still allows for code behind. There are many people who
shun it,
who actually feel that code behind is a no-no. It's there as a necessity. It's there for quick prototyping, but in reality, you should always code without a code behind.
Right.
What the view model does is it expresses the logic driving your UI as an object model. Now, because WPF allowed, you can bind to objects in your XAML, now you have the logic of your UI, like, is this button enabled? Is this animation active? Is this panel visible? You know, are these controls even there? Now you can do a lot more separation between what makes your UI work and how does your UI even look.
Okay, so let me make sure I can wrap my head around this, because I fully haven't yet, is that, you know, for every element that I have in the user interface,
right,
which would be defined completely, you know, in XAML, I've got kind of a corresponding object that has the behaviors that would bind to that XAML.
Right.
So if I wanted to, for instance, have a, you know, text box, you know, that was a password, you know, input control thing, right?
Right.
I would have, you know, enabled, disabled. I might have, you know, is complete, you know, so, you know, that have they filled in the whole thing, or I might have a length property to that.
Right.
Right. And I would have the object sitting there completely defined in code.
Right.
And that would allow me to test that separate.
Exactly.
From the actual XAML itself.
Exactly. So this is where it really shines, is now because your view model and your actual view are separated, now I can say, okay, I want to test my UI, but I don't want to use your average UI automation tool to do it. I want to actually just use regular unit testing.
Yeah, anything that uses pixels or,
right,
you know, back in the old days when we used to look at ThunderForm and go down,
right,
to the objects themselves, we're very brittle from a testing standpoint.
Exactly, because once your UI changed, you had to rewrite your automation script.
So you're not testing the look and feel by any means, unless that look and feel is deemed important enough to put it in the object.
Right.
Interesting.
Exactly. So it's basically, if I'm filling out a credit application, has the user filled out this section here on their basic user information? So the first name, the last name, their social security number. Okay, they filled that out. Now let's enable the next section.
So there's a lot of probably important from a look and feel standpoint, but irrelevant, you know, attributes.
Right.
And you would never express those in code, right?
Right.
You would just, you know, have that in the XAML layer. Does this lead to the ultimate in the fact that, you know, the designer can kind of have at that one layer?
Right, exactly. So there's a lot written about the designer-developer workflow. So basically, the way I see it is that, you know, as a developer, I can go in and just put the elements that I believe the UI should have, just do a really dry, bare-bones mock-up, and create a view model that supports it. And from there, I can hand it off to a designer who knows how to make pretty glowing animations when something's enabled, or twirl around the text box when you put in the right answer, you know, and they can have at it, and neither one of us have to really worry about impacting the others.
Well, that's an interesting example, because, you know, there is an animation. How is that modeled in this pattern?
In most cases, you wouldn't. So, like, if I'm going to animate based on if a control becomes enabled, I want to probably put a glow around it. I just, in my view model, I would say, okay, this control is enabled, this button's enabled, and the designer says, oh, when this control gets enabled, I'm going to make it glow.
Okay. Or, well, it might be glow now, and you might decide to flip it, you know, in the next iteration of the application, right?
And that's, as a developer, I don't have to care about that. The designer has total control over that.
So how old is this pattern? How established is it?
You know,
because I only heard about it, you know, within the last couple of months, and it was an MSDN magazine article that we'll point people to.
Right. It was actually, I did a little research after I first discovered it, and Martin Fowler had given the first mention of a similar pattern. He called it presentation model, which is basically the same thing, viewer presentation.
Okay.
So he has that on his Blicky, and that's been out since actually 2006. So
okay, so a couple years old.
Yeah.
Well, sorry, I got to work on my math. About 3 years old now?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's 2009, Brownie.
Right. That's amazing.
So tell us about some of the things that you do, you know, with WPF. You know, don't want to hear about your day job, right? Because that's that's the boring stuff, right? but tell us about some of the applications that you've kind of done on the side. And you've actually showed me one of these. It's a very leading question. So.
Right. So I've been tinkering around with this idea of stream-oriented computing back in the mid-80s, I believe. I think this was University of UC Berkeley. They had an experiment or research project called LifeStream. And the idea is, instead of doing document-oriented UI, you know, where, you know, I want to work on a science report, so I open up Word, or I want to fill out my spreadsheet for annual reporting, I open up Excel. They say, what is it that I'm doing? So it's a task-oriented UI rather than a document-oriented UI.
Okay.
And I'm not sure if this was I had read about it before and it was subliminally implanted in my head, or if I just taken this approach on my own. I don't recall having read about it. But, you know, while working on some software, I was like, you know, there is a task that I'm doing that gets me from one point to the next. And I just sat down one night and wrote about it for a few hours, and then I made up a little mock-up in pet project of it, and I called it Flow. So in the idea of a stream of consciousness, so it flows like a river, and then it tied in somewhat with, there's a Russian psychologist, I'm not going to even try and hack his name up right now.
Okay.
Csikszentmihalyi. Mikhail Csikszentmihalyi, he wrote about the concept of flow being, you know, entering a state where you're not even aware of your surroundings. So nothing's in your way. You're unimpeded. And that was one of my main concepts here. You know, get the computer out of your way. Make it work the way you work. So.
And this is how we think.
Right.
I mean, I've caught myself doing this, you know, particularly like when you're trying to unwind at the end of the day. You know, you all of a sudden you'll have one thought and you're like, how did I get here? How did I get to thinking that I needed to call the repair place to get the radiator in my car fixed?
Exactly.
And you got there through like 8, 10, 12 steps, and you can back up. And it turns out that you started thinking about that because, you know, you were going to go to a basketball game this Saturday, and, you know, you were thinking about, you know, the game and, you know, parking and, oh yeah, there's traffic going downtown, so I got to account for that. and then you stumbled on, oh yeah, my car's been, you know, the radiator's been acting up, right?
Exactly.
So it's at any point, you know, there's this flow that's naturally going on in your life.
Exactly.
Right. But so how do you capture that in an application, WPF or not?
So, that's the thing. WPF definitely enables an interesting visualization. So I took the concept of a stream, a sequence of events or thoughts or artifacts, whatever you want to call it, that you can visualize. And because of WPF's binding, my stream can be represented however I want to. So the important part was the structure of the stream. So what are the important parts? The stream itself, the artifacts, and whatever visualization that goes along with the artifacts. So the first concept I did was visualizing the stream of browsing the web.
And this is almost like the first use case for it, right?
Yes.
Yeah, because browsing the web is very, stream oriented.
Right.
I start up my home page. I click on something. I go, ooh, yes. Shiny thing. And I click on something else. Ooh, shiny thing.
Exactly.
And just like my example of how you think, if you get 12 pages into it, you're like, wow, how did I get here? And luckily, we have this thing called a back button.
Right.
That you can actually, retrace your steps.
Yeah.
But you did it in a much more, visually oriented fashion. And
exactly.
Tell us about that real quick.
So, I found a control that allows you to visualize a graph. Yeah, a graph with nodes and connection points. So I put every link that you click within your web browser as a separate node. So you can go to that one web page that you visited and then go back to it without losing where you went afterwards and then start clicking off from there. So the
so it's no longer a serial process of backing up, right?
Right.
And we'll put a link in this because I know you've got a version of the application out there that people can download and touch the bits, right?
Yes.
Maybe we'll do a screencast with it or something like that. But what's cool about that is that if I get 12 deep, I don't have to go back and remember it. I can actually go back, 6. I can go back 12.
Right.
And it almost creates this branch, spider web effect.
Like a river.
Jump back. Like a river. It's a Springsteen song, right? Like a river that I don't know where it's going,
Yeah. So, going on to the, shiny thing, I said, here's an example. Just start off at
MSDN homepage, maybe, right?
Yeah, MSDN homepage or your favorite blog and click on a link. Click on each tracked link from there. And then, from there, just click on each link that you see on that page and so forth and so on, And I've done this a few times, with Jeff Atwood's blog, he's always referencing his old posts and, you'll have 20 tabs open or whatever. And so it's an interesting way to visualize and organize that.
So where do you take Flow from here? Because I assume at this point that somebody's going to go out and look at it, look at the screencast or something, download the bits, play with them. Because one of the things that is it still missing in the version that you've got out there that, there's no way to store the data?
Right. There's no way to store it right
now. So as long as you keep it open, you're fine, right?
Right.
And by the way, we should mention that this is using an embedded web browser control.
Right.
So it's not like you have to, attach an add-on or anything to your existing browzer. You're actually doing it right within the WPF application.
Right.
And experiences, you open up Flow and you start browsing.
Yeah, exactly. And so the idea is that the web browser, like I said, to me was, a first use case, a way for me to get an initial proof of concept for myself out there. The idea from there is that you have stream providers. So, your email might be a stream that you want to visualize, your Twitter stream.
Yeah.
So anything that you might want to receive information from, your stock market provider would do something that allowed you to receive updates on your stock market. From there, that email you receive might have a link to a website that you should go read. So the idea is that it's not documented oriented. So you're not jumping out of one application to do another activity. So right now, if I get an email in Outlook, I click that link and up jumps Internet Explorer. Very disjarring experience, and you lose your context. So with the idea with Flow is that, what you were doing, what got you to this place is actually still there in your context, and you can go back to it. And if your coworker comes and pops you on the shoulder and asks you to look up, figure out how to write FizzBuzz in C#, you can stop that and then come back to it. Your context is all in one place, and you can say, oh, well, this is what I was working on.
So this sounds like a really big project, and it's going to be interesting to see how this evolves, over time.
Yeah.
It's a really cool concept, and you almost think, I could take this so far as to not have menus. On my operating system, not have application icons, not have document types, but I could have an interface where I just, start.
Right.
And you might need some historical context, right? There might be like a search box.
Right, right.
That says, you know, well, I was working on, you know, that presentation.
Right.
You know, let me find that presentation where I picked up. What's nice about it is that, you know, whenever I'm doing something, getting back to the same spot takes me a long time.
Exactly.
Right? Like, you know, invariably when I write code and you've seen me present, you know what an awful coder I am? You know, I have to have 5 or 6 browser windows open, you know, for documentation, code sample, you know, debugging, you know, trips, tips and tricks. I'm going to get it right. You know, and then, you know, Stack Overflow, you know, so I can ask questions, right?
Right.
For me to rebuild that context every time I want to do something is a ramp up time.
Right.
Sounds like with fully implemented, like Flow, I could go right back to what I was doing at 3:30 yesterday when I got interrupted.
Yeah. And the big idea is that once you're able to save your stream, why couldn't you share it with your friend? So, like, the idea is that this would be fully serializable and be the ultimate social application, I guess.
Yeah, you need to control access to it, though.
Oh, yeah.
There's some people I don't want seeing my stream.
Well, there's a way to do that.
Okay.
So, like, was looking at from the first moment I saw it was Live Mesh,
yeah,
and Live Framework. So the idea with Live Framework is that the user, whatever application data the user deems to put into their mesh, they can share it with friends, they could put it public or whatever. So it's almost like a entirely new web.
Well, cool, Mike. Thanks for sharing your thoughts.
Thanks.
You know, teaching me a little bit about you know, WPF patterns. And, you know, thanks for being on The Thirsty Developer.
Well, thanks for having me, Larry.
Thanks for listening to The Thirsty Developer. This podcast is available on the Zune Marketplace and the iTunes Music Store. You can also find a link to the feed at thirstydeveloper.com. For general comments on the show or to suggest a topic, send an email to thirstydeveloper@live.com. Or send us a message on our new Twitter account, twitter.com/thirstyd.